Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is lost when a word is spoken for the very last time in human history? Fully half of the 7,000 or so languages actively spoken in the world today are expected to be extinct by the end of this century. And even today, we are losing one about every 14 days, along with immeasurable quantities of knowledge, tradition, and culture. Journalist Russ Reimer is a visiting professor at Smith College. He went around the world to visit the places where some of these threatened tongues are still spoken for his National Geographic article, Vanishing Voices. It's in the July 2012 issue of the magazine and features photography by Lynn Johnson. Russ, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
So we have about 7,000 languages remaining in the world today, but what's the breakdown with regard to the most commonly spoken as opposed to the least common?
Well, the vast majority of the world's language speakers, meaning us humans, speak only a small percentage of the languages. So there's a tremendous disparity between the languages like English or Spanish or Chinese and those at the bottom of the scale, Altaic or Yanomami. Chinese, for instance, has almost 1.25 billion speakers, and yet there are a number of languages these days that are down to one or two remaining speakers.
And in those cases, very often those speakers have had to learn a second or third language just to communicate.
Yes, which is not necessarily such a death knell for the language that they natively spoke. Tribal cultures, by virtue of being small, are generally multilingual, far more than we tend to be, because we can find a lot of people who speak our language and do our commerce in the language we're used to. However, more and more, the commercial culture of the world and national languages tend to dominate and shoulder out the smaller languages, so that if you speak, say, Akha, one of the languages I investigated in India, do you encourage your children to speak Akha? They will have to do their commerce in Hindi, and they will have to speak English, far more effective, you know, a parent might argue, to raise their child speaking one of the dominant languages and let the tribal or group language be abandoned.
Yeah, it's really interesting how often economic forces are the things that seem to endanger these languages. People move from isolated areas to bigger cities. They need to speak a common language, or as you mentioned, if they need to, participate in trade, they will need to speak a larger common language.
Yes, the irony is that places, large cities, for instance, New York, often ends up being a repository of last speakers. But in their native habitat, there is no refuge from Mandarin and English, Russian, the dominant languages that are spread via the media and via commerce and become the lingua franca.
You write, any language with a television station and a currency is in a position to obliterate those without. If people who speak isolated languages want to engage with the outside world, they really have no choice but to communicate in the more common tongue.
That's true. There's absolutely zero chance that the outside world is going to come to Paliji, tiny village in northeast India, and try to engage the people there in Akha. They're going to arrive in person or via the television set, speaking English or speaking Hindi. So in a way, that speaks for a richer life in Paliji, because everybody there speaks several languages. On the other hand, it means that the richness of the cultural life that Paliji has enjoyed for time immemorial is eroded by the incursion of these new languages, because the native culture was never a culture that spoke English or Hindi. It spoke Akha. And the language is fundamental to culture. It's not one of culture's ornaments.
Yeah, I want to talk more about that. We have all heard examples, of course, of words or of phrases that are pretty much untranslatable from one language to another. You learned, as you mentioned, that very often these are tied to ideas and values that are specific to particular cultures. Can you give us some examples?
Sure. In another place I went to in the course of doing this story was Kyzyl, capital city of the Russian Republic of Tuva. People there, the native language is Tuvan, although Russian has long been a secondary language, and also Chinese, because they're on the border of Mongolia. Tuvan was a declining language, giving way to Russian. These days, it's on the rebound. And when I spoke with Tuvans about what did their language contain that would be untranslatable, they mentioned several things. One was Kumai, which is throat singing. It's a native art form that when most people who know about Tuva think of Tuva, they think of throat singing because it's one thing that has been exported. But despite the fact that the world is interested in Tuvan throat singing, Tuvans maintain that you cannot understand Kumai without a deep intimacy with the Tuvan landscape and nature, because the throat singing is so tied to the language, and the language is so tied to the local nature. Hmm. Another was Kojoziri, a Tuvan word for the method of slaughtering a sheep. We don't have a word in English that contains the as many concepts packed into it as this does related to slaughtering an animal. But the Tuvans kill a sheep by cutting an incision in the skin and then reaching through that incision to pluck and sever a vein that allows the animal to die painlessly, basically to bleed to death internally. It sounds gruesome to us, but it's actually prized as a method among the Tuvans because it is merciful to the animal. They cringe at the way most of the world slaughters its animals. So the word for slaughter has actually taken on a tremendous sort of cultural inflection that implies kindness, generosity, looking out for the welfare of another. And that kind of packaging within a word like that is something that is distinctive to the Tuvans. All languages have these. And yet all languages have different packages. And when you lose the language, you lose that sort of coincidence of concepts that go into these individual words.
I think my favorite example in the article of the way that language can shape and reflect the way we see the world is in the Tuvan conception of the future being something that is behind us while the past is in front. And this, I think this will stick with me for a very long time. Can you talk about that?
Well, it is completely unimaginable to us. But a Tuvan, for instance, and this is, they're not alone in this. There's also an Amazonian tribe that has the same concept. Tuvans would never say, "I am looking forward to tomorrow," because they see the future is behind us and the past is ahead of us. We, of course, can't imagine thinking that way, but in the Tuvan mind, it makes complete sense. If the future was in front of us, then it would be in plain sight. So they say the future is the thing we can't see, therefore it must be behind us. The past is the thing that we can see. It must be in front of us. And their language completely reflects that. They talk about looking back to their plans and looking forward to what happened.
I just love playing with that in my head because it makes you realize the many things that we take for granted that must be universal to human experience that are, in fact, cultural. And, you know, travel does that anyway for us as Americans, I think. Mm-hmm. But it really does make you realize that the thing that you think everybody can understand is maybe not understandable.
We take so much to be just ingrained in our human nature. And then one of the lessons of language diversity is how much of this is contained in culture. Base 10 number systems are not universal. Many languages have different setups for relating numbers, including some languages that, like Jaraja in South America, that get by with just few or greater, and do not have any more specific terms for number. So number systems are very mutable and very much interpreted by the language, and color, too. We think that it's absolutely just a matter of human nature that the color spectrum is what it is. When we see red, it's red. When we see yellow, it's yellow. Well, the distinction between red and yellow does not exist in some languages. And if they wanted to say, they may prize something that's yellow more than over something that's red, but when they express it in vocabulary, there's only one word for that, expression. It would be red or yellow. So as linguists are looking at these languages and documenting these languages, so many of which are still completely unknown, undocumented by the outside world, other groups of anthropologists and people who think about how the human being is constructed are being given a wealth of material about how our mind works and how our experience affects the way our mind works to categorize the world in completely different ways.
How has the study of different languages evolved since Noam Chomsky posited that there was this universal grammar that we all shared?
Well, Chomsky, of course, was working in generative linguistics, in sort of the philosophy of linguistics that deals with how do children learn language and what is language's underlying form. And Chomsky's revelation was that there was, he theorized, a single universal grammar that was contained in the human genes. The linguists that are working on language diversity are working at the far other end of the linguistics trade. Comparative linguistics is not an overlap, really, with generative linguistics. However, the two very much affect each other, because whether or not you agree, if you're a linguist, with Noam Chomsky, finding these new languages, new to science, and documenting how they work reveals tremendous information about the underlying grammars that we all engage in when we speak English or Russian or Mandarin. So, so in linguistics papers, you frequently find new revelation about language acquisition or generative linguistics containing what's been discovered in a small language in Mexico, for instance, that uses a grammatical formulation that previously everybody agreed no one used. So the more languages that are documented, the more we expand our knowledge of what's innate about language and what's cultural. And since Chomsky's theory was that language is an innate human characteristic contained in our genes, what we're finding out about is a deeper understanding of what makes us human.
We are speaking with journalist Russ Reimer about his article Vanishing Voices in the Current National Geographic. Here's a cut of Charlie Red Hawk Tom from California speaking the language Karuk.
My name is Red Hawk. The white language doesn't go deep enough to feel.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Nuk Johnny Albanian, Nuk Nuambar. My name is Johnny Hill Jr. and I speak Chemehuevi. Huruka Nuka Nahombi Vakari Nuk Nuambao. Nuka Chuka Pani Hambao Nuk Kamba Pihiwa Pan Mechiva Pihiwa Pan Unis a base. Hatan okay may so katan to some as way you katan to some kambao about Nakuruk men kachuk pani hambao pihiwa pan unis a hambar.
I said, well, when I'm at home, when I speak to myself, I do not speak it out loud. I speak it inside my heart.
It's just deep down inside me. I do it inside myself. I don't bring it out. That's how I do it.
That is Johnny Hill Jr. of Arizona speaking Chemehuevi. We are speaking this hour with journalist Russ Reimer, who's a visiting professor at Smith College and author of the article Vanishing Voices with photography by Lynn Johnson. It appears in the July 2012 issue of National Geographic magazine. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or you can send email to think@kera.org. Russ, we heard Johnny Hill talking about the fact that he speaks his native language often just in his heart, in his mind. And you write about the very poignant instance in some cases in which there is a single speaker left for a particular tongue.
Mm-hmm. You know, languages like Wintu or Yuchi, both of those are Native American languages, or Amerindak, an Aboriginal language in Australia, are down to one or sometimes two, in case of Amerindak, fluent speakers. And at that point, of course, a language may still be documented in part if a linguist comes upon it, and there are great efforts to document these languages before they die. But functionally, the language is already dead. There may be a last speaker, but there's not a last conversation. That's already happened.
Because you brought it up, we actually have a cut here of Casa Henry Washburn of Oklahoma speaking Yuchi.
Henry Washburn is my name. And Yuchi, they call me Kasi. Yuchi, I can wear the name, and they're willing to tie. I can, it's just a holiday. I got to get the gated tiny. Nehezi gated tiny. I don't want to see this language die out. I want it to live forever.
Did you find in your travels and in your studies, Russ, that people who are losing these languages are, in fact, very much invested in making sure that they survive beyond their own lifetimes?
Yes. And a tremendous amount of pride in the language in the places that I went to. But the level of investment in a language seems to differ from language to language. Hmm. And it is a factor that linguists and also people in the community, the communities I visited, point to as being a decisive factor in whether a language dies or lives. Tuvan is rebounding in Siberia, but a neighboring language, Tofu, is down to 30 speakers now. Hmm. What's the difference between those two? And the difference seems to be, at root, a matter of investment and pride. So I remember one time in Palyaji, the small village in northeast India in the lesser Himalayas, which is very remote, very far from American culture. The people there had never seen a dollar bill and asked me if I could produce one. I didn't have one, maybe fortunately. So it's a place on the earth that is probably as far from the sort of cultural imperialism of the great languages as you can get. And yet, these two teenagers came up to the linguists that were working there one day and said, "Can we show you something? We have something prepared for you." And they said yes. And these two teenagers went immediately into a rap song that they had written that was so fine-tuned, it was just pitch-perfect, South Central gangsta rap with all the gang signs and the head bobbing. They had the form down perfectly. And I was dismayed myself. I thought, I've come all of this way just to encounter this little artifact of American culture. The linguists were delighted, and I asked asked them about why, and they said, well, because those two kids speak English and Hindi. They could have rapped in a language they share with millions, and they chose instead to make their rap song in a language that they share only with a little more than 1,000 people. And that is an example of the sort of pugnacious pride that some communities have in their language that seems to be the deciding factor in whether that language will continue on another generation and ultimately thrive, or whether it will die on the vine.
Do you think, Russ, that part of the reason we're losing some of these languages is that the world over, people have come to think of language as almost an economic commodity as much as a cultural artifact?
That's absolutely true. And one of the interesting things about visiting these different places and talking to these people who, about their language was the that we're not talking, when we talk about language, we're not all talking about the same thing exactly. That for some of us, language is just a tool to get through the day and do our transactions. And I think in industrial cultures, that's more and more true. I remember a time, since I grew up in the South U.S. partly, and partly in the Northern U.S., I remember a time when Americans, and especially Southerners, thought of language in more storytelling terms. It was not information-oriented so much as it was narrative-oriented. And I was reminded of that in places like Kazil. The Tuvans prize storytellers, and the storytellers, because these are traditionally nomadic herders that would have reindeer or sheep or horses that they would herd around the steppes, depending on the season. But these storytellers would travel from encampment to encampment to tell stories, and it was the way the culture operated. It was the way information and news was presented, but a story would take days. And so the community would gather there to listen to these stories that would take the storyteller several days completely by memory. Of course, now that culture is bumping into how do you keep this same tradition alive in the era of tweeting? You know, in the era of the 140-character message, because the cell phone has replaced the storyteller, how will Tuvan translate into this this new form, which it has to do if it's going to stay alive? But it's not just keeping the language itself alive. It's keeping so much of the culture that's attached to the language intact. And that's a very difficult question, because the world changes and cultures do too.
Yeah, that's interesting, because for a language to stay alive, you can't, in fact, encapsulate it in time. Vital languages are adding new words and sort of dropping words out of the lexicon all the time.
And for instance, one group I visited were the Seri people in northwestern Mexico on the Gulf of California. Another nomadic peoples. They speak the language Kamikitom, and of course they are an isolated people from the majority culture around them, but invariably lots of intrusions. They have cars, they have electricity now, so they have television. One thing that the linguists noted about the Seri people was that as they get new things, like cars coming into the culture, they find their own vocabulary out of Kamikitom to apply to these Western, these industrial machines, so that they're not just adopting the Spanish. It's another element of pride. They have, instead of saying muffler in Spanish, they say in Kamikitom, that which the spirit goes into. Instead of saying distributor cap, they have a word that relates to a stinging eel in the Gulf that will give you an electric shock. So they're finding ways to adapt their language to the intrusion of outside culture, and that's a healthy sign. If you have it's a bit of a conundrum, I guess, but if you have a language that is perfectly preserved, that's another way to kill a language. And a healthy language is one that is being modified to confront its environment.
So it might seem to people at first glance that the way to stanch the flow is to just get somebody in there to write down languages that have not been written before, create a dictionary, preserve the words. And there are various groups of people doing this, notably missionaries who want to create a written language so that they can put the Bible in front of people. And this can be helpful, but there are some precautions that need to be taken as well, and some impact from simply committing to paper something which has never been written down before.
Well, part of, for instance, the storyteller aspect relies on a language being an oral, a verbal form, and not a written form. And yet, and so linguists are very wary of how their efforts to document a language, for instance, may be changing the language.
One.
That said, it can be a very exciting thing for a culture to receive a written form of a language that has, down through the generations, been verbal only. And once a lexicon, an alphabet, has been applied to a language and a dictionary done and the language becomes written as well, it can be part of the resurgence of a language. I traveled with Steve Marlett and Kathy Mosier Marlett, a linguist and ethnographer, who have worked to document Kamikitone. And Kathy Mosier's parents actually began, they were linguists, they began work on a dictionary that Steve and Kathy have now completed in Kamikitone. And now the children are actually writing books, and the adults. There's a renaissance of Seri culture going on within the written form, because people who have been paying attention to Seri stories and Seri wisdom down through the ages have now, these individuals are finding a way to actually set down the stories. They're doing it. It's not coming from outside. So this is a healthy sign of something being coming in from the outside, the linguists who help with the dictionary, being completely just grabbed and taken over by the indigenous people themselves and used to their purposes.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Anne Marie in Flower Mound. Hi, Anne Marie.
Hi. I wanted to comment on up in northern Wisconsin, my nieces and nephews learned the Ojibwe language in public school, and the word for blueberry pie, which never existed before, is actually describing the steps you take to make blueberry pie, starting with picking the blueberries and making the dough through to baking the pie. And as a cook, I realized that when I do all of these things to make pie, it's actually in the back of my mind, the steps. So I can understand this whole concept.
And it's... Well, I'm glad you brought up Ojibwe. That's an interesting language that one of the linguists that I was traveling with in India was laughing one day. We were in Delhi, and I asked him what was up. He said, "Oh, I just got a text message from one of my colleagues in Pennsylvania, and she's an expert in Ojibwe, and she insists on texting in Ojibwe." So Ojibwe is another language that is finding its way in the world. But what you talk about, this sort of practical knowledge embodied in a language, is one of the facets that so fascinates linguists and that I found fascinating. A tremendous amount of just practical knowledge about how to get through the day. Local, everything from local recipes to how to harvest eelgrass if you're on the Gulf of California, to how to read a cow's liver if you're looking for omens about an upcoming marriage. There's all these sorts of cultural prescriptions that are contained within in the language that are too easy to lose when the language dies, because they don't really translate very well into another language.
There's scientific knowledge at stake here, too. And I always love stories of scientists discovering, and I'm using air quotes there, a new, say, animal or plant species. And then if you talk to the people who've been living in that region for generations, they can tell you that it's something they've known about for a long time.
And in fact, the Kamiki Tome language has entered the scientific lexicon because there's a shark that science was ignorant of, but of course the locals knew all about it. And so the name for the shark, when it was discovered, has been has used the Kamiki Tome word hakat, which means shark. But also the Seri have embedded in their language information that science thought was outlandish at first, and then came to accept as scientific verity. They are very aware of the sea turtles. Some they used to eat some of them, and others they did not eat. They never ate leatherbacks because they thought that leatherbacks were Seri and could understand Kamiki Tome. But the language has a word for a turtle that descends, and the word implied that the turtle hibernated in the sand beneath the ocean, which scientists found outlandish until they discovered that, in fact, there was this species of turtle that did exactly that. And so the paper in Science that described this actually lauded, saying that discovered this through the Seri language, and that the Seri had turned out to be remarkably accurate reporters on the nature around them, which makes complete sense if you think about it, because the large languages of the world are not as close to and dependent on the life of local species as the small languages are. Speakers of small languages often live in very close proximity to nature and are extremely close observers, because their life and livelihood depend on it, of the species that they encounter.
Journalist Russ Reimer is my guest. He's a visiting professor at Smith College and author of the article Vanishing Voices. It appears in the July issue of National Geographic magazine. If you want to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
My name is Josephine Wildcat Bigler. And when grandmothers called me, they call me Fine, the Ezeki. That is my name in Yuchi.
Maxine's Ati. Yuchi ha kidon. So akene ha. My name is Maxine. I'm Yuchi. We are still here.
That is Josephine Wildcat Bigler and Maxine Wildcat Barnett of Oklahoma, speaking little bits of Yuchi and some English as well. My guest this hour is journalist Russ Reimer. He's a visiting professor at Smith College who wrote the story Vanishing Voices for the current issue of National Geographic magazine, with some spectacular photography there as well by Lynn Johnson. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we hear from David in Grapevine. Hi, David.
Hi, I'm enjoying the show. I have a question. I was born and raised here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area and went to school in Massachusetts in the 80s. And I noticed around that time, you know, there were so many different regional accents within the U.S., from southern to western to northern, Boston versus New York. Looking at mass culture now, I'm kind of noticing that there seem to be less accents, almost as if everyone talks like a Valley girl or something like that. I'm wondering if you've noticed that yourself, what might be the cause, and also maybe where, if this trend is happening, will it continue?
Thanks for your call.
Well, David, come back to Massachusetts. I do think that I live in Cambridge right now, and I I came moved back east from San Francisco several years ago, and I was amazed that Bostonians still speak Bostonian, that the accent seems to be pretty robust. But, you know, in Georgia, for instance, where I'm originally from, I do think that you just don't hear the old, fierce Southern accent that you used to. I think we are kind of evening out. And that's a factor, or a similar syndrome to languages actually dying, because with an accent is an expression of the way a language is used. As you were saying, Chris, before, is it just used as an economic tool, or is it used for other purposes? I was really moved by your couple of Yuchi speakers. Yuchi has four remaining speakers, and you know, Mr. Washburn. I've never heard these tapes before. I did not travel to Oklahoma. So many of the language hotspots where languages are most endangered are right here in the Americas. You know, I guess the highest diversity of languages would be in New Guinea. There's 140 endangered languages in New Guinea, but then you come home and you see how many languages in the Pacific Northwest and Oklahoma. There are 866 endangered languages in the Americas as a whole. So this is a phenomenon that is not just in small, out-of-the-way places. It's going on all around us. And it's not, again, not something that's so easy to quantify. I spoke with someone the other day who was saying, wouldn't it be better if everybody just spoke one language? I mean, then you'd have a level playing field. Everybody would have access to the same information and the same opportunity. And I thought to myself, how do I explain how moving it is to me to hear someone like Mr. Washburn speak a language that is down to four speakers and that he hopes will survive, and how much, even not having met him and not knowing a word of Yuchi, how much I cherish the fact that it's there.
You know, even hearing Josephine and Maxine talking, first of all, I found it moving when they said, "We are still here." And I think it was Josephine who said, in English, "When grandmothers call me, my name is Fine." And that is not that's not a phrase that we would typically use in English. And I think we all understand what it means. But that itself is a key into the way the Yuchi culture might think about language, about family, about tradition.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, in India, I was traveling with David Harrison and Greg Anderson, two eminent linguists who are working with National Geographic on the Enduring Voices Project. And they were very eloquent on this question of what's lost. David and Greg also had worked in Siberia compiling a dictionary many years ago, and so they put me in touch with a woman named Valentina Suzukai in Kazil, in Tuva. And she was talking to me. She's a musicologist, actually, but she's very interested in the confluence of music and language, and was talking to me about how language forms the soundscape that we exist in. Mm-hmm. And I became attuned to that. This goes back to the accents that David was talking about. We walk out the door in the morning, and we are lost in the song of our culture, expressed through the language. And it's, aside from all of its informational aspects, language forms this intense, ongoing, interlinking web that is around us all day long and forms not just how we do business or how we learn something, but how we think and how we move. I was speaking with a Kamiki Tom speaker, Rene Montaño, in Suriland. And Renee was saying, if one child grows up speaking Kamiki Tom and another child grows up speaking in Spanish, they will be different people. And although that's a very hard thing to kind of come to grips with, I find it to be profoundly true. I loved one expression that I heard among the Seri, a Kamiki Tom expression, inside every person is a flower, and inside the flower is a word.
Hmm. There are also some tantalizing clues to culture, I think, in the words that don't exist. And you have an example of the Akha in India having no word for job, at least in the sense that we think of it today.
Sure, they have a way of saying a chore or something that you need to do, but they aren't people who exist in a commercial culture at all, or at least they are now currently, but it's an incursion. They have time immemorial been subsistence people, raising their own rice, yams, oranges, slaughtering their own livestock, and so the idea of going to work for somebody else is, and a lot of them now go to work for someone else at the sawmill or building roads for the government, but that idea is not something enshrined in their language. They don't have a word for that implies salaried work.
What have you learned about cultural biases and racism or ethnocentrism in different parts of the world that would keep parents from passing on a native language to their children?
How exactly do you mean?
Well, you know, you hear stories here of immigrants coming to this country and avoiding teaching their children anything other than English, even though that was their second language, because they were afraid of their kids being teased or being identified too much with a so-called outside group.
Mm-hmm. And, in fact, it can be dangerous in some instances. The Sari were in a very uncomfortable relationship with the surrounding Spanish-speaking Mexican culture for centuries. And managed to isolate themselves sometimes violently. The first priest that the Vatican set in to bring the Sari into the Catholic fold was killed, and the Vatican decided not to send another back in the 1700s. But the Sari could be penalized in the outside world for speaking their language. So they, along with having to cut off their braids to try to blend in with the outside Mexican culture, if they had to go outside of their territory to do commerce, was a real injunction not to speak the language because it could be penalized.
Do you think the continued move to urban centers rather than people staying where their ancestors have lived for centuries is going to continue hurting languages? You mentioned New York City as a repository, but I wonder how long that can last.
Well, I think it is a repository, but I think that especially the small languages are so connected with their environments. And I'm speaking a little above my pay grade here on this particular question, but it seems to me that the languages and the communities that I witnessed in my travels the language was so very intimately connected with the environment that I can't imagine it having the same role in life if it was being spoken in Queens.
Hmm.
So the language, there are a lot of ways to keep a language technically alive and have it lose its life, the life force that makes it so vital in its native locale. I think that there are probably varieties of dialects of large languages might do better in say New York City, because they may already be a language that is mostly devoted to the things that New Yorkers devote their lives to, commerce, an outward religion. But I think many of these small languages would have their own sort of substrate kicked out from under them because they don't have the environment that they refer to right there surrounding the language.
Is there a sort of formula for getting young people involved and invested in learning a language that maybe they didn't learn from birth but ought to have an interest in?
I think that, and again, this is something that I have, as a journalist, not a very large representative sample here. I've talked with linguists and I've explored a series of languages, but it's hardly encyclopedic knowledge. But I think that from what I hear from linguists, that is the aspect that has to come from within. There's a lot that can be done to help a language from the outside. There's certainly a lot that can be done from the outside to document a language, of course. But ultimately, whether a language survives or doesn't has to come from within, and it has to come from the young people. I was with a young man in Paliji, India, who brought out his father's shaman's kit, containing a tiger's jaw and the jaw of a river pike, and some crystals and some other things. And he explained to me that his father died in 1991. His father had been a shaman. His father before him, this young man's grandfather, had been a shaman. And I asked him, will you be the next shaman? And he said, no, I don't have the language. My father died before he could tell me the chants.
Hmm.
So here he had the cultural artifact, much as you'd see it in a museum, wrapped up in its father's sachet. But he didn't have the language that would make those articles come culturally alive.
How did the translation work for you as you were traveling all over the world for this story?
Well, I had the luxury of traveling with some wonderful linguists like Harrison and Anderson, or like Steve Marlett and Kathy Mosher. In some cases, those were linguists that go to a lot of places and will spend some time there working and then move on. There is an expression, helicopter linguistics, that linguists use derisively to talk about people who just kind of drop in on a culture and get what they want and then leave. Harrison and Anderson are remarkably not that. I mean, they keep going back and back and back to these villages over the years to familiarize themselves over a long period of time, becoming part of the life of the town, actually. I especially love traveling with Steve and Kathy Mosher because Steve Marlett and Kathy Mosher, because she had grown up there. She was born within the culture and grew up in El Desemboque, this little Surrey town on the coast. And so her translation for me went far beyond the words. It was a very deep cultural translation, and of course that makes things that much richer.
And I would imagine there are some things that can only be noticed about a language and its qualities by someone who also speaks another language to compare it to.
Yes, and in fact, I mean, that's very interesting. I think that the encounter with linguists for the people in these very small towns that I visited with linguists was galvanizing and intense on several levels. It's very complicated, and it's quite intriguing to watch. First of all, just the idea that the outside world would care is brand new news to these people, for whom the outside world has so far only showed up to trample, linguistically.
Afraid we have to jump in there. We are out of time. Russ Reimer is a visiting professor at Smith College and wrote the article Vanishing Voices for the July 2012 issue of National Geographic magazine. Russ, thank you so much for giving us this hour.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answered the phones. Christine McConnell will produce the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.